Hello everyone, before this episode begins, I just wanted to give a quick disclaimer. I actually recorded this episode almost a full year ago. I was planning on doing a series on the Living Books games, which we'll get into in this episode. And Living Books was a series of edutainment games, like interactive storybooks that came out in the 90s, and I loved them dearly. And I was actually in contact with the creator of the series, as well as the CTO of the series, or the CTO of Broderbund, who developed the series at the time. I was lucky enough to get to speak with the CTO, Mickey Mantle, in no relation to the baseball player. I bring that up in the episode. Anyway, unfortunately, I could not set a date with the creator of the series, so I didn't want to delay this any further. It's already been delayed almost a year, so I figured I got to do it now. I can't keep putting this off, so yeah, here it is. This episode, like I said, recorded almost a year ago. I hope you enjoy it. And without further ado, here is the episode. On this episode of Still Loading, Mickey Mantle. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this new episode of the Still Loading Podcast. I am your host, Josh Koval, and today on the podcast, we are continuing the Living Books series. And for those who do not know what the Living Books series is, Living Books was a series of interactive storybook adventures that came out in the 90s, and it was published and developed at one point by Broderbund. Did I pronounce Broderbund correctly? I always feel like I butcher that. There we go. I'm leaving that part in because I feel like other people confuse it too. Broderbund. And then, you know, actually the series has an interesting history of changing hands of who's developing and who's publishing. There's like, it goes all over the place. But they were a series of interactive read-along adventures that came out in the 90s, and they were storybooks, you know, Dr. Seuss and Arthur and tons of others. Stella Luna was another one of my favorites. And with me today is the CTO, or he was the CTO of Broderbund at the time of it being released, and he is the CEO, right?
That's correct.
He is the CEO of its current publisher, Wonderful Interactive, Mickey Mantle, no relation to the baseball player. Mickey, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good, thanks.
I wanted to get that out of the way because I'm sure you get that joke a billion times and we're just not going to bring it up anymore.
No problem.
But seriously, thank you so much for coming on. Living Books, like I was telling you off mic and in our correspondence leading up to this, they were a big part of my childhood, and I want my daughter to be able to play these as well. So my first question for you is actually pre-Broderbund. So I saw like some of your history before this, and you worked at Pixar right before Broderbund. So
that's correct.
What kind of led you to, like, how did you get involved with Pixar, and how did that then lead into Broderbund?
So I'm going to rewind just a bit before Pixar even.
Go for it.
So I happened to go to the University of Utah at a time in the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, when it happened to be one of the few places in the world that was doing 3D graphics.
Okay.
And so I went there and took courses from Ivan Sutherland, who's kind of the father of 3D graphics, and David Evans, who had a company called Evans and Sutherland that made some of the very first 3D equipment. So I went to work at Evans and Sutherland after I graduated college. And while I was at college, by the way, I happened to have a class with Ed Catmull, who was the co-founder of Pixar.
Okay.
And several other notable people who've since done some amazing things. So it was a great experience for me, but I became a 3D graphics guy, basically. And I did 3D graphics, interactive graphics, when there were a few places in the world that you could actually do it. And so that led me eventually to, after I'd been at Evans & Sutherland for 11 years, I was recruited into Pixar just after Steve Jobs bought them out of Lucasfilm.
Okay.
And they brought me in because I had worked with them with some of the equipment that we had sold them from Evans and Sutherland. They knew me and me from college even. And so they brought me in to manage their software development. And so I was in charge of their external software products at Pixar. And so I was there for about 7 years. I eventually was general manager of their 3D graphics group.
Okay.
And Steve had been funding the company, Steve Jobs, the entire time. And he was getting a little tired. So they had this great new plan. Most people don't know that Pixar actually started out as a hardware manufacturer. They made a Pixar image computer.
Okay.
So I helped develop the software for that, managed teams that did that. But Steve eventually decided we're going to become an animation company. Okay. And of course, that meant internal tools. And I didn't believe they'd continue selling the external tools. Turns out they did and have continued to sell it even to these days.
Really?
Called RenderMan, which is used by almost all the special effects houses for doing rendering.
I did not know that Pixar sold software.
Yeah.
That's it. Okay.
Compared to their movies, it's small change, but it keeps them on their toes.
Yeah.
It's not only having you eat your own dog food, but people are also eating your dog food. So you have to do a great job.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so at that time, Broderbund came and knocked on my door and said, you know, we're looking for a CTO, VP of engineering. Would you like to come do it? And quite frankly, I was sort of reluctant in a way, but yet interested in another way. And when I went over to take an interview with them on site for the first time, they showed me this thing they had in the development that they were calling living books.
Yeah. Okay.
And so they showed me this and I went, wow, this from Pixar to this. Yes. This is it a step down in some ways, but it's a step up in other ways.
Yeah.
Because when I went to Broderbund, not only did I have the animation group working for me, I had the sound and music group. It turns out I'm a musician. So that was a very interesting thing for me.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to all the software development and QA and other things. So I had a fabulous team at Broderbund and we had a lot of fun. That's where, of course, Living Books was developed. And that always had a special place in my heart there.
That's interesting that Living Books was the thing that sold you to go to Broderbund in the first place. How much creative input did you have into the Living Books series? I know Mark Schlichting was the one who created the series, but how much creative input as the CTO did you have? Was it minimal because you were kind of managing everything, or did you have more hands-on than you thought?
So by the time I got there, a lot of the basic work was done.
Okay.
But I continued owning this as my own technical project. Okay, they had dedicated programmers there who didn't report to me, but kind of reported to me,
mm-hmm.
you know, matrix in a way. And so I attended the meetings once a week down at the Living Books studio. And I paid special, I felt it's my own private project. And it was always had a very close place in my heart because I thought it was by far the best product Broderbund did. And they made some great products.
I mean, I was like looking at your credits on Moby Games, like you don't have any direct credits in terms of like things on the game, but a lot of special thanks. And there's a lot of big games on here that you are involved with. Myst obviously is like Broderbund's big, that's the one that everyone still remembers. Then obviously, I don't think I actually see it on here, but Riven, the sequel to Myst, I see it on here now. And one of my favorites, I only got to play it at a neighbor's house, but the Zumbinis game, The Logical Journey of the Zumbinis, Carmen Sandiego, like there's just a lot of big games, not just this Living Book series that you worked on there. So what were kind of, I mean, you kind of went into it a little bit, but what were all of your responsibilities as the CTO at Broderbund?
So I was actually the vice president of engineering and CTO.
Okay.
And they have separate kind of scopes of work. One is more about managing, the other is about leading. But I managed teams directly and indirectly, and we morphed various ways as I was there over the 7+ years I was there.
Mm-hmm.
Can do it differently. We started out relatively small and we grew and grew and grew and had to find better more efficient ways to manage programmers and the creative people, the animators, the artists, the sound engineers, the musicians, the QA people.
What's like one of your earliest memories of working on the Living Book series?
Well, so to be clear, I never worked directly on any of the products. I managed people who worked on the product.
Okay, I gotcha.
And so your original question was, what was my creative input? Zero. Okay, that was clearly in the hands of the animators and Mark Schlichting and his creative team. However, you know, I did get a chance to review them and about the quality, and also to help make sure, often an unsung thing, that you have enough resources to get the job done.
That makes sense. And especially with something that I feel like what's surprises me about the Living Books games is at a time when there wasn't really a lot of voice acting and there wasn't really a lot of just voice acting in general in video games, period, or interactive media at the time. The fact that there was full voice acting for the most part with a lot of these, and it was not bad. Like a lot of times the voice acting from that like early 90s, it was like, all right, who in the office can do this? Who in the office wants to do this? And was that the case? Because if so, you fooled me. But was that the case where there was people in the office doing a lot of the voice acting?
So there actually was a lot of it done by people in the office. But okay, there's also a lot of professional talent they brought in. We actually created a whole literally recording studio so we could take and do recording of the voice talent as they were for the various games, not just for Living Books, for a lot of the games.
Obviously Myst and Riven, like a lot of those end up having a lot of interactive media with it. What were some surprising challenges you ran into as the CTO while working on this series? Was there anything that just kind of jumped out at you that was like, wow, I wasn't expecting this?
Well, so the biggest challenge was that there was a set of expectations for how much one of these products could be produced for.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark was never meeting that challenge. And hard to believe, you know. So the CEO, who this was his pet project in many ways as well, CEO was Doug Carlston. He was always at loggerheads with Mark over trying to get the products done effectively, you know, more efficiently. So we went through lots of things trying to develop, not only for Living Books, for other products more efficiently. At the time, people won't think much about it today. We're one of the few companies who actually can produce cross-platform products. Cross-platform at that time meant Mac and Windows, or Mac and DOS and then Windows. And with one set of code base, because we developed our own framework to take
Latest
from the operating system. And that included media and streaming from CD-ROMs and so forth. So there was a lot of very excellent technical work that went on behind the scenes.
That's especially impressive because Mac and PC now aren't as far apart as they were back then. Like they were very different in terms of, I mean, I'm not a programmer or a CTO, but I know like their operating systems were so different compared to now. They run on very similar hardware and software. So that's really impressive. And obviously DOS is completely different than those two as well.
Yeah. Luckily we stopped DOS not long after.
Were there any particular moments that you are proud of while that stick out to you while working on the series? Was there something that like you were able to get done that you weren't expecting to get done? Or are there any particularly proud moments that you have while working on the series?
So probably the proudest thing, and the thing that actually we'll follow up on this later as we talk about how I decided to publish the products again. The products were made using a pseudo language. The assets were created Macromedia Director, and then literally converted over to a platform neutral format that could be used on Mac or Windows.
Mm-hmm.
And so that particular piece of engineering was a spectacular piece of engineering, and all the products were what I call data-driven, in the fact that the code was for a general player, and that player could take and play any of the books.
Okay. And
so they were all embodied by the data, not by handcrafted code in the products. Now, as the products went on, they actually tweaked a little bit of things hand by hand.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll touch on that later too.
Okay. So I think I'm getting what you, I think I'm understanding that.
So I actually wrote a paper about this that I actually up on the wonderful website that described how Pixar did the same thing in this Render Man that I talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
It's scene description language for 3D. Okay. So the living books format, which is called Mohawk, took and was program independent and product independent. It allowed you to do things independent of the specific product you're working on.
Okay, I get what you're saying now.
So I found the parallel quite amazing. Like I said, I put a paper up on our website that I wrote for Computer Graphics World describing how you took these old products and could update them to the latest platforms because they were data independent from the programs.
That's really cool. That's super forward. That's future proofing it essentially. And at least I don't know how much, because technology changes so much. So I don't know how future proof it could have, how far into the future it could have proofed it. But that's still really cool. It's impressive.
So to kind of tie that in a bow here, the way Pixar needed to do that is that they made the products at a certain resolution long before, you know, HD film and 4K and so forth. And before there was stereo imagery, when stereo became a big thing in theaters, they had to go back and re-render all of these. Now, they couldn't go back and redesign them. There's no way they could afford to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
But because they had the data, okay, they could take and redo it with a different viewpoint for one eye and a different viewpoint for the other eye.
Okay.
And re-render it all without having to re-program it in any way.
That I'm tracking that. I get that. So in thinking of Pixar, were you there when they started working on Toy Story at all? Because I'm assuming that was a good couple of years. Like, they came out in 95? 95, yeah. So that, I mean, and you were there up until the early 90s. So that was like a good couple of years before it came out.
So I actually left just as they started production of Toy Story.
Okay.
I actually got a credit in Toy Story.
Did you?
Because I was there. So it's a very small credit.
But still, it's a credit. It's more than I have.
So, I was there. But quite frankly, it became clear to me that Steve was taking the company a different direction. He tried hard to keep me there, but I didn't succumb to his reality distortion field.
So over the course of working on living books, what were some things that you learned from development? Like what lessons did you learn as development went along? I would assume over the, you know, it went for almost a decade, the series. It went from, like, what I have it up right here. I see it, like, earliest entry is 92 that I can see, and the last one came out in 99. So it went for pretty almost a full decade. What were some changes in how these were developed as they went along?
You know, the technology didn't change that much under the covers.
Okay.
It became a little bit more flexible by adding some features that had some custom things that people wanted to do. We had to add features to do that. But the technology didn't change that much. And quite frankly, the production didn't change that much as well.
I was just going to ask, what types of new features got added along the way then?
So if you go back and you look at the history of living books, there were things, there were like two versions of Just Grandma and Me and two versions of Arthur's Birthday.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the second versions added more deeper interactivity things. And so those couldn't be done in this general fashion that I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
They are coded in for that particular product. And that was good. That's what marketing wanted.
Mm-hmm.
It was bad later on for me because I actually haven't been able to make use of those products because they're not independent.
Oh, okay. So for when you picked up the license for Wonderful, you couldn't make use of the new iterations, the new changes made to some of those old games.
Yeah, we'll touch on that later and talk about that licensing.
I mean, at the time of recording this, I haven't been able to speak with Mark yet, but I wanted to kind of ask you what, like, the development of Living Books. It started out in Broderbund, and then it looks like it went independent for 3 years from 94 to 97, and then it came back to Broderbund in 97 through 98, and then it went, that's just development, but publishment, I see Broderbund, I see Random House, I see The Learning Company, I see Mattel, The Gorge Group. Like, it goes all over the place. So what is there? I feel like it's
simpler than it appears.
Okay, okay. Is there any easy way to describe how all that went down?
There is. So in the early 90s, the notion became content is king. And so people were out trying to buy licenses and so forth. And so Living Books was the perfect vehicle for licensing. So they went out and licensed from famous authors. And part of that was trying to get some of the works from Seuss,
mm-hmm.
which were owned by Random House, published
okay.
by Random House. So Doug, trying to make it bigger and also hedge his bets a little bit, took on Random House as a partner, convinced them to join in a partnership, and they spun it out of Broderbund. Okay, it's a separate company, but it was co-owned by Random House Living and Broderbund.
Okay.
And so they moved out of our headquarters in Marin down to San Francisco. So I would travel down to San Francisco once a week for a meeting with everybody there to find out how things were going, what I could do to help. But Mark can cover that in much more detail. He was in the middle of all that. You know, he had to go talk to Theodore Geisel's wife.
Try
to get her to license the products to Broderbund and so forth.
That's crazy. Okay, so that makes a lot of sense then. And that also kind of makes sense what you're talking about, because that was the, I'm assuming that 3 year stretch are the games and the enhancements that you aren't able to access currently. Am I correct?
It's not that black and white.
Okay.
But so what happened is, so they had this independent organization called Living Books, okay, reported into Random House and Broderbund. Random House, things happened at Random House after 3 years, and they decided they didn't want to do the same. They got cold feet or they changed their mind. I never heard the exact story. I'm never quite interested why. And so it was brought back wholly within Broderbund. And then Broderbund was sold to Mattel.
Okay.
It was sold to the Learning Company, who in turn, shortly thereafter, sold the Learning Company, Mindscape, and everything they rolled up under the Learning Company to Mattel. They sold it for $4.3 or $4.8 billion, as I think.
Billion as in B?
Yeah.
That's like 90s money too. So that's adjusted for inflation. That's a big chunk of change.
Well, it gets better because 1 year later, they sold it off for $1 and a promise of any future revenues. The CEO of Mattel got fired over it. Poor thing, she got a $56 million golden parachute. But she actually was the main person that made Barbie so big. So that's how.
Oh.
So that's interesting. So it was sold off to Gore's Technology, as I recall,
mm-hmm.
who in turn sold it to
a company
in Ireland.
Riverdeep is the next one I see.
Yep. Which was in turn acquired by Houlton Mifflin Harcourt, where the products remain to this very day.
Okay, so then let's kind of branch that into how Wonderful comes into this, your company Wonderful, because you have the license for it as well, but is that only for like mobile devices or how? Because if Houlton Mifflin and you are able to use it, where, how does it get broken up, or is it all one and the same?
It's all one and the same.
Okay.
So obviously through a series of serial acquisitions, such as we just described, Broderbund to the Learning Company, to Mattel, to Gores Technology, to River Deep, to Houlton Mifflin Harcourt, there's a lot of information lost along the way.
Yeah.
None of the people survived who knew anything about it. Okay, there was nobody at River Deep who really knew anything about it. One of our people actually consulted with them. Her name was Ginny Walters, and our QA manager, director at Broderbund, consulted with them to try to understand what they had, as I recall. But by the time that I went looking for the licenses, there was nobody at Houlton Mifflin Harcourt who even knew they owned the products.
I feel like that is unfortunately the lot of a lot of IPs and whatnot, and not just in this, but like in movies and games and all types of media. It's like stuff gets rolled up. This is just a quick anecdote. There's that film director, Kevin Smith, and he made a movie called Mallrats in the 90s, and it's owned by Universal. And when he wanted to do some sequel to it, so when he called them, they're like, oh, we own that? And just, no, it gets wrapped up and companies don't know what they own because there's just so much content out there now.
Yeah.
That's crazy. So, okay, so then they didn't know they even had it. So did you create Wonderful to as basically show them what they, not really show them what they had, but kind of to take the reins for them in order to republish it?
So let's rewind just a little bit. So even after I left Broderbund, I was fascinated by living books and wanted to keep them alive somehow.
Mm-hmm.
I worked with a guy who took over for me after I left, named Mike Folger, and we had this idea to take and put all of the living books onto one DVD.
Okay.
And to go license the products from and run them off one DVD as opposed to a bunch of other ones, and you put collections together and so forth. Turns out a living book pretty much filled a CD-ROM, but a DVD had room for lots more.
Yeah.
So I thought about that before, but when Steve Jobs, same Steve Jobs, I might add, held up the iPad for the first time, I went, this is the device that Living Books needs, always needed. And at that point in time, I was thinking of retiring from my current company, which had been acquired by Sony. It's a company is called Gracenote.
Okay.
I had this idea that maybe I could take and bring them back for the iPad. Now, I didn't think bringing them back for the iPhone was very compelling because they were so small.
Mm-hmm.
You can look at it. Turns out it's more compelling than I thought, which we proved later. But still, iPad was the perfect device and still is. So I set off on a course to take and figure out how feasible it would be to take and develop a technology for it and to take and license the rights to it. So I set out on a path to do that in parallel, a technology path. So I hired the main programmer who had built the Living Books player to make a new version of it, a prototype, just to show how it could work. So I could go talk to Houlton Mifflin Harcourt about it. And he did. He threw something together, and certainly wasn't a product. It was a prototype at best. And I went off and tried to talk to Houlton Mifflin Harcourt, which took me 6 months to find somebody I could actually talk to about it.
Just because no one knew what it was? Oof.
So.
Okay. So who did you end up having? Was it someone higher up that you had to end up speaking to? No, it was a
business development guy.
Okay.
Sorry, I don't remember his name off the top of my head, although I do give him a credit in the wonderful apps. So I went off there, and after I negotiated with him for about 6 months. So a year after I started, I finally had a contract in place to do it, which gave me rights to license the content. Now, I would have also asked for the source code, but much like, you know, the Lost Ark at Indiana Jones,
mm-hmm.
It put the source code away and they had no idea where it was. So there was no source code as part of the license.
So did you have to build it all back from scratch?
Yes.
Oh.
Now, turns out that wasn't that big of a deal because of the state of independence I was telling you about. If I could do it for more than one product, I never would have done.
Mm-hmm.
But if I did it once, most of the products would work as if by magic.
Well, it makes sense because, like you said, the way it was designed in the first place, it was a very malleable template to just plug and drop everything in. That would be, if they could find that, this is a little bit of a non sequitur, but there is a fantastic nonprofit called the Video Game History Foundation. And what they have a thing called the Source Code Project. So if you end up finding the source code, I'm not affiliated with them. They don't know who I am. But if you somehow find the source code, I'm sure they would love to have it because they're trying to find a way to archive all of this. And so they actually had a demonstration where they had some of the, I think it was Ron Gilbert from Lucasfilm or LucasArts Games. And they showed the Scum engine that they used to make their, you know, Secret of Monkey Island and whatnot. And they showed how malleable that was. And just you talking about the Living Books engine, it would be a really cool presentation to see, like, this is how we developed these games on here. You look how easy it is to, I know drag and drop might not be the exact right term, but for lack of a better term, with my limited understanding, you drag and drop, you know, these assets in and out. So that's really, that makes a lot of sense why just, as soon as you could get one, it was just easy to port the others.
Actually, there was no porting. They just worked.
They just worked? Future-proofing. That's incredible. So even technology from the way you designed the technology in the 90s still worked with the platforms today.
As a matter of fact, in addition to losing the source code, they lost all the tools they used to create the assets.
Oh.
So they didn't have any of the assets. Okay, so the way I created these products is I scrounged every CD-ROM I could find, okay, and just used the data directly off of it.
Makes sense.
The good news is they just work. The bad news is if I wanted to change anything, it was almost impossible.
I could see how that, yeah, because you don't have the source code or the engine to, you don't even have the original code for the engine to make any changes to it.
Well, I could do anything in the engine, but I couldn't change the content.
Mm.
And so just for example, in order to take and create the splash screen, which now says wonderful in the Living Books.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. One of the guys who worked on Living Books happened to have an old setup that he could produce a little bit of an animation in the format that was required. And so we managed to get that done. That's the only change we've made to any of the books that isn't the substantive.
Okay.
So we also, in order, because we had to adapt them a little bit. First of all, let's say why there's wonderful as opposed to Living Books. Holt Mifflin Harcourt would not license me the rights to Living Books, because they might use it sometime in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Of course they won't, but
that's, yeah. Everybody never will.
Remembers that it's still there now, except for the people I send money to. so
as it goes with every company.
But anyway, they wouldn't give me rights to it. I I did negotiate rights to say originally published as Living Books. So I have the right to say that. But I don't have the right to use the Living Books logo like it's behind me here.
You had to modify it, or it had to be, because I actually have, I have the sampler literally right here on my phone. I don't know if you can see it. Yeah. There it goes. Yeah. You can see it. And originally published as Living Books. So you can keep that logo down there on the bottom, but that's it.
That's it.
That's crazy. How else are people, I mean, well, I guess if they're trying to create it for a new generation, but if they're trying to,
they're not, they had no interest in using this for anything.
That's just silly. It's especially because, like you said, it is, and I'm not just saying this to like be a kiss ass, excuse my language, but like to be a kiss ass or anything, but like it's perfect for the touchscreen format. It makes total sense.
Yeah.
So then that's how you got the Living Books license, excuse me, for Wonderful. And is there any other things that you're planning on doing with the Wonderful company? Are you trying to see what more else you can do with Living Books through it? Or are you trying to branch out and do other stuff through under the Wonderful name?
Not really.
Not now, really.
It turns out that one of the guys who worked as part of the programming team for Living Books, who continues to consult with me, he's my main developer.
Okay.
They actually created a Living Books creation tool.
Oh.
And we've always wanted to go back and we'll let anybody create a Living Book-like thing. But quite frankly, I've never actually finished all the work in getting all the Living Books out there.
Mm-hmm. So,
until I did that, I wasn't going to take on any more work.
I getcha. Well, besides Living Books, you also co-authored a book that we were talking about called Managing the Unmanageable. So what could you tell my listeners about this book?
The book is basically a distillation of my 40, 50 years of developing software, distilling the information my co-author and I, who also spent almost as much time as I have managing programmers. And we found that there was very few books out there that actually talked about how to manage people as opposed to manage projects or manage, there's a lot of stuff about different tools, compilers and so forth, but very little available at that point in time to take and tell people how to manage programmers. So I'd always had this idea to take and write a book. I originally had the name of the book was very cliche at this point, but it was actually not a cliche at that point, which was Managing Programmers a Lot Like Herding Cats. But, that later became a commercial on TV and everything. So, we changed the name along the way to Managing Unmanageable and had a great editor for us. I actually published a book at Pixar called The Render Man Companion
for
Addison Wesley. And it turns out that the editor was still there, and I went back to him. And Ron had already published a book using the same editor, so he knew both of us, my co-author and I. And so he encouraged us to do it, and it took us a lot longer. It took us about 7 or 8 years to actually write the book. But it distills the information about how to be a great manager and take care of your people.
Now, without giving too much away from the book, because you want people to read it, what would you say is one of your better, what would you say is a good tip for people manage, for a good managing tip in general? Obviously, don't give the whole book away. Just, something to whet people's appetites.
There's 10 chapters that are loaded with managing tips, so I couldn't give you one, but I'll give you a couple. One is, to learn from the wisdom of others. So we've loaded the book full of quotes and rules of thumb from people who develop software. So as a matter of fact, the entire middle of the book, we had them printed in gray as opposed to the white pages. They're gray pages that are filled with over 300 rules of thumb and nuggets of wisdom. The very first one is from Andy Grove, Intel's CEO for a long time. Managers must manage. That's his rule of thumb. You have a problem, you got to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. You can't pawn it off on someone else.
Yeah. So the other thing for a technical manager is, we think that the most important thing for a technical manager is to have the respect of your staff. Okay, this is diametrically opposite for what Dilbert has for his manager, the pointy-haired boss.
Yeah.
He has no respect. And that's why he can't be managed. So we go into things like that throughout the book. There's all kinds of stories about, my days at Pixar and Broderbund and talking about the great programmers I had there, one of which who led the Living Books effort.
Mm-hmm.
That's chronicled in the book.
That's really cool, especially because, like I was saying, like I love this podcast is dedicated to not just video game history, but video games and video game history. So being able to have a book like that, which like I was telling you off mic, not a lot of people talk about. I don't think enough people talk about Living Books just because it was such a it. Once again, it's going to make it sound like I'm being a kiss ass, but like it was one of the best ways to make books feel alive. And the best way I can describe my emotions towards it is that I loved, Dr. Seuss and the Berenstain Bears and Arthur. And so I would read those, and playing the Living Books games was like, this is like the sequel to that same book that just covered the same story. But it was like, this is like the enhanced version. This is like the HD remake of a book, but as an interactive story. And I thought, and just all the little bits and senses, little bits and the sense of humor that it had, like all the weird, goofy things that these developers would put in, it there's a lot of charm to them. And still, like I was actually showing, my wife is a preschool teacher, and I was showing her this. I'm like, Joe, she was like, this is perfect for, she teaches a little bit too young for it. She teaches like 1-year-olds, but 1 and 2-year-olds, but for kids older than that, and obviously it's geared towards like 6 to 9-year-olds. Like you could use this for a wide range of kids. And my sister-in-law, she works with kids, she's with special needs, and also that would be super beneficial to them. I think I read something, it was really helpful for kids who were on the spectrum, or I believe, am I correct?
There are many, many Living Books fans who are on the autistic spectrum. And I've interacted with many of their parents who call and beg me to please update these because they can't keep their old computer working anymore. Okay. And their children who grew up with these as their best friends. And some are now 30 plus years old. But I mean, I have stories of a girl in Oregon who learned to talk from Sheila Ray.
Really?
Yes. She couldn't speak until Sheila Ray made her talk.
That's amazing.
And I still have their fans call and talk to me. I mean, some of the autistic folks call and talk to me and begging me to take and get the rest of the books done.
That's just a testament to it. And it just, I loved this series so much. So this was a lot of fun to get to talk to you. Is there, before I kind of start wrapping stuff up, I have two other questions for you. Three other questions. One, what was it like to, besides, we talked a lot about Living Books, but what was it like to work on the other big titles at Broderbund, Myst, Riven, and then Zubinis? Like, what was it like to work on those and not just the Living Books games?
Broderbund was one of the greatest experiences of my life. It was a very family-like atmosphere. It was a lot of fun, a lot of pressure. It was like making a movie. You got to hit the Christmas deadline,
Mm-hmm.
And so we had to do a lot of inventive things. Quite frankly, most of my efforts there were in problem solving. So
okay.
I wouldn't say it was necessarily exciting and fun for me all the time because I usually was fighting fires.
And I feel like a lot of those experiences are ones that in the moment you don't realize that you're enjoying it until after it's gone. At the same time, you don't have to deal with the stress of that moment anymore, which I'm sure is very beneficial, in hindsight. But that's good to hear though. It kind of like, just seeing the breadth of their library that Broderbund had, it really seemed like they were really doing a lot of innovative things, and not just like, obviously Myst just blew everyone's expectations out of the water, but Living Books, the different branches between the edutainment side of things with the just straight
application side of things, because I believe Broderbund still exists, but now they're more of just straight like applications for the most part.
Well, it's actually licensed.
Oh.
And it's all owned by Holt and Mifflin Harcourt and licensed from Holt and Mifflin Harcourt. Now, for example, Software Makiev, who was one of my contractors when I was at Broderbund, has taken, and it has Kid Picks, it has Print Shop, has several other titles that they've licensed from Holt and Mifflin Harcourt and then taken in, and probably without source code, and made work again, just to keep the brand.
Makes sense. Because it still has a little bit, it still has some recognition, especially with people of my age and older. But okay, so
just one more thing.
So oh, no, go for it.
I'm actually, because they licensed Stella Luna, so I couldn't license it from Holt & Mifflin Harcourt. It's part of my license because they had licensed it. So I went to Jack Minsky, who is the CEO there, and I told him, I can make it live again. You have the license. We'll split the royalties. So that's what we did. So it's published now by them. We actually deliver a finished product.
Now, this question wasn't originally on my list, but I'm just looking at it now. Because if I look up Wonderful on the App Store, I do actually see like a Green Eggs and Ham Dr. Seuss one, but it's from Ocean House Media. That's not, is that the Living Books thing or is that something completely different? The only reason I ask, because like you said, there's all this licensing stuff all coming from Holden Mifflin, but I wasn't sure if that one was with it or because of the Dr. Seuss license, it was just way out.
So actually that's one of the disappointments I've had with Wonderful is that I haven't been able to actually license all the products. Okay, the very first product, Living Book product, was Just Grandma and Me by Mercer Mayer.
Mm-hmm.
And Ocean House Media got the license before I did. Okay, and I tried and tried and tried to get Mercer to take and license it to me also. He refused to do that. I tried to get him to license it to me in foreign languages because I have foreign languages of it. Ocean House Media has none of those. He won't do that.
Hmm.
I tried and tried and tried to get Sheila Ray from HarperCollins, okay, and the author Kevin Henkes. I almost had it. The person HarperCollins who I deal with, who's friendly to me, says, like to do it, but Kevin said no.
Hmm.
I wrote Kevin a letter directly, Kevin Henkes, the author, begging him for the children who still love these.
Yeah. You know,
and he didn't answer the letter, went to HarperCollins and told him to tell me no. So I haven't been able to get that one. The Seuss products, Ocean House Media has all those as well. And they won't license them to me.
I mean, it's
they almost hung up on me.
Wow. Seuss. I think that's just a little odd considering you had the license. It'd be different if it was some completely random person, but since you had the license once before, I feel like that should at least have your foot in the door or something. But
well, I think that by the time it got to Holt and Mifflin Harcourt, they created a bunch of enemies. This is what I got. This is the drift I got.
Mm.
Because they were not forthcoming with royalties and so forth. And so... when I told Seuss Enterprises that I had licensed the product from Holt & Mifflin Harcourt, they almost hung up on me.
Okay.
As I said, Holt & Mifflin Harcourt.
So, okay, that could be it then. That could be it. Another question I have is, why did you want to bring Living Books back and why did you want to update it to for modern audiences?
Well, you know, I always thought that these products were some of the best ever made. And I think they hold up well against anything out there today. For example, if you look at, you mentioned Ocean House Media in our discussions, if you look at those products, they pale in comparison to these products. Now, they actually were done by a guy who worked with Broderbund and knew all about how it was done. And he made his own engine and he's done very well with it. But again, I don't think the products stand up well to these. And I felt that I didn't want to see these great products not be available to another generation of children. So I did hope to make some money off of it, but quite frankly, that was never the point of it. It was always to make sure these were available so kids could enjoy them. And there's so many anecdotal stories I have about people learning to read in a foreign language who were in Japan and learned to read English from living books. And so we have them in various languages. They come in Spanish, they come in French, they come in German, they come in Japanese, and Portuguese and others. So to be able to reach a worldwide audience with these books, and now there's more and more people with phones and tablets.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just felt like another generation or even two deserved them. We had to do one thing, which was actually very subtle but important to do. The original products were done in a very low resolution because the computer screens were not very big back then.
Yeah.
Back, they were all done in 512 by 480.
Mm-hmm.
No, 512 by 384. Okay. Which is very small. On a computer today, you couldn't see it. On a tablet, it would be small.
Yeah.
On a phone, it would be small. So the processors today are powerful enough that you can actually resize the graphics on the fly on the way to the screen.
Really? It upscales it right off the bat.
Upscales it to whatever size tablet or computer monitor you have. So we built that in, and that made them more up to date, but they still look pixelated because they are. That's the way graphics were done then.
I do think pixel art, and maybe this is just me being nostalgic, but I think pixel art actually is still, it's making a comeback in somewhat, because there's a lot of indie video games now that are using the pixel art aesthetic. And so because of that, and it's not just these are small niche games. Some of these are huge, major, popular games. And even to some extent, Minecraft, like that's the one of the, that's probably the largest game in the world, if one of the largest, if not the largest. And there's a podcast I listen to called Retronauts, where they focus exclusively on old video games and whatnot. And they talk about how the one host talks about how his cousins don't really have that much of an interest in the retro games, or they didn't. But once they started playing Minecraft, every time they would see a retro game, they're like, oh, this is like Minecraft. So I think keeping that pixel aesthetic is a good thing, because a lot of times when you update the art, it's a hit or miss. And I think the pixel art in this still looks really good.
It does. And so we're very proud of what the work we've done, and glad to be able to get them out there for the children of the world.
So last two questions. One, what is next for you? What are you currently working on? What do you have going on?
So I continue to work on our living books. I'm about finished with all the work I set out to do. That's a goal for this year, is to kind of tie it up in a bow so that I'm not really working on it at all anymore. And it's been a 10-year run, so it's about time to put that to bed. I'm, as I mentioned, consulting with certain startups, and I've got one who I'm particularly interested in at this point in time that I believe I can help. And also have another book in the works.
And the final question I have for you, nothing to do with anything we talked about. This is a new thing I've started. Well, I shouldn't say new. This is a thing I do with all my interviews. It's a question from my wife, question from Courtney. And now my wife is famously not into video games or a lot of this other stuff, so it doesn't have usually anything to do with anything. So her question for you is, what is your go-to order at a pizza shop?
It's actually not my go-to order. It was my CTO's at my last company. So it's got to be pepperoni and mushroom pizza. You
know? Pepperoni and mushroom, really? That's an interesting combination. I was not expecting to hear that one.
I had a lot of it at the company. So.
All right. Well, that is all I have for you, Mickey. Seriously, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Still Loading. Is there anything that you talked about your writing a second book with your co-author? Is there anything else though that you'd want to promote, or is there any place that people can find you online? Obviously Wonderful Books, but is or Wonderful Interactive. You can find that on Android. Is it on iOS as well?
It's on iOS, tablets and phones, Android, tablets and phones, Mac OS, and Windows. So okay. We covered all of them. So you have to look hard to find the Windows ones, but there are available. I would like to thank you for the opportunity to talk about this. I never mind talking about this. It's always fun. And thank you very much.
Well, thank you once again for joining me. This was a lot of fun for me too. It's like I was telling you off mic, this is something that I grew up with. So to get to speak to the people who worked on it is honestly just a real treat for me, because it's something I like video game history. I like computer history and software history. So this is very, even though I'm more on the video game side, all of it's interesting to me. So this has been a real treat for me. So with all that said, as usual for me, you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at StillLoadingPod on all of them. If you want to reach out to me, you can contact me at StillLoadingContact@gmail.com. You can also go to my website, StillLoadingPodcast.com. If you want to support the show, you can do that in a number of ways. Probably the easiest way for you all is to go to Apple Podcasts or whichever podcasting app you use and give it a 5-star rating and review. That helps more people find the show. You can also support the show at Patreon. Even just $1 a month will help grow the show. And the most important shout out I have is the Bit by Bit Foundation. The Bit by Bit Foundation is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to put video games and video game consoles in the hands of children receiving inpatient care at hospitals. So if you want to go check them out and consider donating, go to bitbybitfoundation.org. That is all for this episode of Still Loading. Once again, Mickey, thank you for joining me, and I will see you all next time. Quack.